take a look at the. Looks like there's a decent pile of questions there. See what's there and see what I come up with. Theravada does not seem to be against eating meat. I'm not a vegetarian, but find it hard to buy meat when trying to practice non-harm, especially given some farming practices. Your thoughts, please. Most people probably know the Theravada kind of standard, which is particularly, Theravada monastic standard, because we have to rely on what is offered to us. If we, as a monastic, see, hear, or suspect that somebody has taken the life of a living creature to offer to us, then we have to refuse. It's more like the Buddha is being extremely practical in that eating meat was a basic standard within the culture and society of the time, and if people shared their food with you, then you could accept it. But one wasn't ever to be seen as somebody who encouraged directly encouraging the taking of life. So. And when you're living in a very rural agrarian culture, things are pretty straightforward. Once you get into a 21st century, more urban culture with a much more of a distance between the actual act of taking life and the eating of it, becomes a lot more blurry, and I think a lot of it is having to make personal decisions of what one feels comfortable with, as the. Factory farming is hard to reconcile with something that you're actually going to put into your system. It's also part of the duty of monks to try to encourage people to be reflective in terms of their precepts and how they hold them, and there's a lot of leeway, but to be able to be reflective and see what works for one. Northeast of Thailand, where I lived as a monk for many, many years, and lived as an abbot for many years, the monastery Wat Bananachat was mostly vegetarian, because we encouraged the villagers to prepare vegetarian food, and after the monastery being established for, 37 years now or something, 36 years. That's very much the case. They're still mostly vegetarian, and the villagers they put up with our quirks and prepare vegetarian food, but you know, it's just not real food to them. So it's it hasn't really made a huge dent in their perceptions. But they're happy to do that. And in reality, some people have taken it on for shorter or longer periods. How are the five hindrances related to the self? Is it the self that is taking an interest in the meditation object? Well, one is to go back and say from the Buddhist perspective there is not self, so that the whatever we conceive of as self is just that. It's a conception. It's conceived assumption. So that to be able to... And the Buddha uses that concept of non-self as a balance, in terms of because self is seen as one extreme, in the sense of a constructed, conceived of self that is only propped up by our ideas and biases, and the other extreme is, say, in the Pali, it's a lot more clear. You've got atta as self. You've got vipratta, which is negation of self. And that's sort of like a nihilistic annihilation or a pushing away of self. And then the balance is anatta, so that non-self, recognizing what we conceive of self as it's not... it's something that is of an impermanent, constructed nature, and therefore can't be held as a self. So it's like that's your middle way, is seeing it as seeing what we assume to be self as a non-self phenomenon because of its impermanence and insubstantiality, and the. And then when we think of, you know, what is it that's taking an interest in the meditation object, you don't actually need to have a self to do all of anything. I mean, you've got the nature of the mind is to be aware, to have a ability to attend and be self-reflective, and what takes an interest in the meditation object is knowing that we prefer happiness and well-being to suffering. In that, when we take interest in the meditation object, when we cultivate a steadiness of attention, the mind settles down. One experiences a continuity of wholesome mental states which result in a quality of peacefulness, well-being, happiness. And that's a lot more preferable than suffering and agitation. So it's on an experiential level as opposed to a conceptual level or an idealized level, in the sense of the idealized self or a conceptualized the concept of a self. For one's coming back to felt experience. Okay. Based on the Buddha's teaching, what do we learn from the bad things which are happening? So that the Buddha is always pointing to causal conditions, in that we when we pay attention to the nature of experience, that is a framework or a pattern that we can start to understand and learn, in that there are causes and there are conditions which facilitate a certain result, and sometimes those results can be pleasant, they can be good, they can be conducive to happiness and well-being, and sometimes they can be the opposite, they can be unwanted, unpleasant, what we conceive of as bad. And the reality also is that each, all of the conditioning goes in all different directions, in the sense that the good can be the condition for more good, the good can be the condition for the unpleasant, unwanted, bad. One can be it can be the condition when one is complacent, or when one is selfish. It can be the cause for more suffering, or more confusion, or more difficulty after that. Similarly, the bad, the unwholesome, the unskillful, can be the cause for increased unwholesomeness, unpleasantness, or it can be the cause for a real shift, a change, and a commitment to that which is good, is wholesome, is pleasant. So that it's completely up to us. That's the whole point of the cultivation of mindfulness and discernment, is so that we can be attentive to the nature of our experience and those causal conditionings, and then having the discernment to be able to see what we want to cultivate, what we want to develop, what's going to be for our long-term benefit and welfare. One of the chants that we do on a regular basis, and is actually from a teaching that the Buddha gave on five subjects for frequent recollection, that all beings are the owners of their actions, heirs to their actions, born in their actions, abide supported by their actions, whatever actions they will do, whatever karma they will do, for good or for ill, of that they will be the heir. So then the Buddha puts that causal process very central to the duty of a practitioner, to be paying attention to that causal process, so that we can, if we're at all reflective, we realize that what we want is decreased suffering, increased happiness, and learning how to develop those causes and conditions that will help that to come into being. impossible for someone who has experienced the first glimpse of the deathless to break any of the precepts. How does an arahant choose their food? Did Ajahn Chah like very spicy food? And in the text, then they yeah, for somebody who has experienced the first glimpse of the deathless, which would be sotapanna, stream entry, yeah, to break any of the five precepts, it's just not it's not considered possible. The and it's important to recognize that it's not say a doctrinal thing, but is a again, it comes back to experiential, in that that glimpse of the deathless of truth is an insight into the nature of suffering and freedom from suffering, and that that being able to step back from not being able to abide in an intention or volition within the mind to harm anything, and remember Ajahn Chah one time saying that it wouldn't matter how much somebody tried to pay him or coerce him to do it, just to be able to take your finger and squeeze an ant to death, it just couldn't do it. The mind doesn't go there. And it's not from the sense of, oh, I keep the precepts. It's more like, no, that suffering is not to be increased. That quality of compassion is what comes forward, rather than some doctrinal adherence to a code of discipline. It's the quality of the heart is such that we can't go there. And there's a very beautiful discourse where the Buddha talks about the five great gifts, saying that these gifts are timeless, are boundless, and then he goes into what the gifts are, and it's the refraining from taking of life, and as the first gift, and ends up following the five precepts, but the reason why they're considered the great gift, because it's the gift of safety, of security, of trust that is engendered by that holding of those precepts, and so that is the result of the holding of the precepts is that it's a wonderful gift to one's fellow human beings, and it does engender that quality of trust and security. Compassion always does that. how does an arahant choose their food? You know, I think it depends on the arahant. You know, in the sense that arahants all have their other than the Buddha, they still have their fundamental personality or temperament, and they're not completely kind of neutered and neutral, so that I think some will be extremely ascetic. Comes to mind. I mentioned Ajahn Mun last night, and extremely gaunt, ascetic, and obviously in choosing his food, he wasn't choosing that much. Come the afternoon time, he didn't have many teeth left as he got older, and the monks would still be making up betel nut for him. They're following a certain pattern that has been held through their lives. Ajahn Chah, I think Ajahn Chah liked his food. Remember one time being his attendant, and we were at a small branch monastery, and the and he didn't go on Omjan that day. He was starting to have trouble with his balance already, and didn't go. And he came back. Came back from Omjan, so he brought sticky rice for him. And sticky rice is glutinous rice. It's pretty heavy, but it's a staple of Northeast Thailand. And Ajahn Chah used to say, you should never make a ball of sticky rice bigger than this size, which for most Western standards, that's monstrous already. And so then I had brought him the basin, and he started making his ball of sticky rice, and it kept getting bigger and bigger. And then it was getting pretty big, and then he sort of looks at it and looks at me and smiles, and he said, I'm getting old, I can't pack it near as tight as I used to. And he did like spicy food. It was, that's what he grew up on, and that's what he enjoyed. Okay, could you please talk about the stages of mindfulness and Noble Path? I think what comes to mind is the mindfulness that is intrinsic to the, or maybe that what pops into mind is this mindfulness and alertness. These are qualities, or mindfulness and clear comprehension. These are it's rare for the Buddha to speak of mindfulness on its own as a it's always in relationship to a few things, in order to be commensurate with the path, then it does need to have these aspects. And there's a discourse where the Buddha asks, what is mindfulness and alertness, or mindfulness and clear comprehension? And then he goes on to define mindfulness as he does in the discourse on the foundations of mindfulness. And there's four particular qualities that the Buddha points to. And I'll use the Pali and then explain what it is. Atapi sampajana satima vinaya loke apichato manasa. So atapi means is associated with effort. It's the effort for the for burning up of defilements, or the undermining of the unskillful, unwholesome tendencies, so that there's an effort that is required for mindfulness, or it has a focus. It's not just some global, vague and nebulous mindfulness. It has a task to do. The burning up of and undermining of those habits of mind that are, because one has to be mindfully recognize what they are in order to undermine them. And oftentimes, that in itself is enough to really be able to see, oh, wow, that is where I keep getting hooked. So that sense of quality of effort. Sampajano is the quality of clear comprehension, alertness itself, and that is that puts mindfulness into a different context, in the sense that the awareness of appropriateness of time and place, appropriateness of circumstance, the appropriateness of what's actually going to work and what's not going to work, what's going to be helpful, what's not going to be helpful. It takes that quality of alertness and clear comprehension for mindfulness to properly function. And I'll give an example that Ajahn Chah used to give. And he talks about a time when he was still fairly young as the abbot of Wat Pho Phong, his monastery. And he had a monk who was senior to him, who used to come and visit, and who was very proud of the fact that he was a mindful monk. And Ajahn Chah said, you know, he was very mindful, but he didn't have much clear comprehension. And he said he would, in the monastic form, if the monk is senior to you, then they would go ahead of you in the alms round. So they would go an alms round in the village, and he would mindfully walk in the front, very mindful, very focused on his sensations or whatever, but he wasn't clearly comprehending where they were actually going. So that, you know, sometimes he'd start walking along and start heading off for some buffalo pen somewhere, or going back out to the rice paddies, or not recognizing that he'd go straight when the lay people are sitting there on the side of the road waiting to make offerings. So he'd forget, he wouldn't recognize, he wouldn't be attentive to the fact that the lay people were off to the right and wanted to make offerings. So that that's a function of clear comprehension, to actually be aware of what's the time and place, the circumstance. It isn't just a focused attention in the present moment, in the present sensation. It's how it relates to the world around us, to the people around us, to the circumstances around us. The third quality, satimā, is one who possesses or possessing mindfulness, so the ability to have that mindful attention. And one of the ways that it's defined that I like is that mindfulness being that function in nature that draws the objects of the senses into the heart and for it to be experienced. And it's like that. That's the quality of mindfulness, is that it's able to draw the experience and draw it into the heart so that it's fully experienced. Now that quality of mindfulness. And the last quality is for the relinquishing of the likes and dislikes towards the world, to one's liking, disliking, wanting, not wanting, approving, disapproving, those kind of swings that we have. That's a function of mindfulness, is to be able to relinquish and let go of those qualities. So that's how the Buddha defines mindfulness consistently through the text. And then he goes on to define, well, what is clear comprehension? And then he said that a meditator clearly comprehends feelings as they arise, feelings as they establish, feelings as they pass away, clearly comprehends perceptions or memories as they arise, perceptions and memories as they establish themselves, perceptions and memories as they pass away, clearly comprehends thoughts as they arise, as they establish themselves, as they pass away. And that's the function of clear comprehension. So that's how the Buddha defines it. So that these aspects of mindfulness and clear comprehension are what would lay its foundation of development and align itself with the noble path. I prefer walking to sitting meditation. Any comments? Main thing is mindfulness, clear comprehension. So that doesn't really matter. Main thing is the ability of the mind to sustain attention, develop clarity, and to reflect on the Dhamma. So that sometimes walking meditation, different people prefer walking meditation, and that's fine. There's one of the great forest masters of the northeast of Thailand who walking meditation was his preferred meditation. He would his name was Lumpu Khao. He's there is actually a biography written of him and translated into English. Disciple of Ajahn Mun. And after the meal, he would go back to his dwelling place, put things away. Then he'd do walking meditation for 3 hours. Then he'd have a rest during the midday, get up, do walking meditation for another 3 hours. Then he'd be late afternoon by then, sweeping, cleaning up, have some tea or something, refreshment, bathe, and then do walking meditation for another 3 hours. Then he'd start sitting. So walking meditation was his preferred method of practice, and he's considered by everybody a sort of awakened being. Actually, at Abhayagiri, some years ago, was offered relics of his, and very beautiful, almost like amethyst, like purpley crystal. That's what the bones after the cremation turned into, this purpley amethyst-like crystal. Very beautiful. Okay, it seems in the West we can be very self-critical. Any comments, please, on compassion for the self? Well, just by when one thinks of the Buddha's the chant that we do on the universal well-being. Spreading loving kindness, and the first person that you direct loving kindness and toward is oneself. And it's the essential foundation. So that the main thing is recognizing, you know, the function of compassion is to understand suffering. And it's not just a, theoretical, externalized experience of having compassion for those suffering beings out there. It's really being able to understand and recognize how suffering, dissatisfaction, discontent, dis-ease, how that arises within oneself, and then how to rectify that, how to attune to that, and how to relinquish that. And the more clearly we're able to tune into that for ourselves, and not in a narcissistic way, but in a recognition that, you know, we're hardwired to prefer happiness and well-being to suffering, so we have to get with the program. I have a great interest in Ajahn Mun. his life and practice. Do you know any other stories about him that are perhaps not in the book of his biography? There's a couple popped to mind, and whether or not they're there or not, I'm not sure. It's been so long since I've read it. But one was just a general comment in terms of, we were talking about temperament, personality, of an arahant. And Ajahn Mun, as a young man, was a very accomplished Mawlam singer. Mawlam is the, I guess it'd be kind of like rap, I guess. Because it's extemporizing and it's very well developed in Northeastern culture, you have to rhyme, and you've got a rhythm that, of course, is, you've got the rhythm, you've got the beat, it's got to come out, and then you've got to come out with a clever repartee as well, so that there's more lump battles back and forth, don't they? So it's a lot. I mean, it's in the northeast of Thailand. It's a huge cultural phenomenon, and everybody is really fascinated by it. Not everybody is of course good at it, but Ajahn Mun was very, very good as a young man. Very good singer, and then as he practiced and then began to teach later, that kind of skill with language, with words, with a quickness, a sharpness of that seizing the moment and going, being able to teach in a really skillful way. That's what came out his disciples. So often you see the picture and you hear these horrendous stories of how strict he was and how he kind of tortured his disciples and whatnot. And the reality is that they loved being around him. He had a tremendous warmth and a skill with language and skill with drawing people in, and this sort of his training as a Mawlam singer is part of it, in the sense of that skill, but also his just that temperament there's kind of a real, maybe joie de vivre that is there, this real joy in living and teaching and engaging that is sometimes not conveyed in the biography or the hagiography. Another one is a story that Ajahn Mahabua tells, and was he was attending to Ajahn Mun, and then one of his senior disciples, Ajahn Phan, came to visit him, and he came in and paid respects, and then he paid respects to Ajahn Mun, and he smiled and sort of said something, you know, about, well, you know, it's really, really fragrant here. And Ajahn Mun sort of, yeah, it really is. And Ajahn Mahabua was, as a sort of a doubting mind, or he was sort of, that's a strange conversation. What they're talking about? And so anyway, they sat and chatted and talked, and they hadn't seen each other for a while, and then they went off, and Ajahn Phan went off and went back to his monastery, wherever he came from. And Ajahn Mun Bhutan asked Ajahn Mun after, what was that all about this fragrant and sweat this moment? And he said, oh, boy, you don't notice these things. He said, but Ajahn Phan was noticing how many devas had gathered to listen to this. As soon as they know that you, he and I were going to be having a meeting and have some discussion. There was all sorts of devas gathered around to listen. He said, but you wouldn't notice. Which reminds me of another story story about this Ajahn, tangentially about Ajahn Mun. Again, Ajahn Mahabua was helping look after Ajahn Mun, and and Ajahn Mun, by that time, was getting older and less vigorous, less energy for teaching, so he wasn't giving as much instruction as he used to. And one of Ajahn Chah's teachers came, his name is Ajahn Tongla, and not a very well-known monk. And actually Ajahn Mahabua told this story to a group of Wat Nanachat monks who was recollecting this occasion. He said this teacher of Ajahn Chah's, Ajahn Tongla, came, and he was a very eccentric kind of character, and he came in, and Ajahn and he said to Ajahn Mahabua, he said, well, started making noise and banging things down below, because Ajahn Mun would be upstairs, and then down below would be, it was on Kuti, the cabin would be on stilts, and it would be underneath there. So he started banging and making a racket, and Ajahn Mahabua said, be quiet, Ajahn Mun's upstairs. yeah, I know he's there. He's there. And he said, well, don't do that, don't do that. He said, well, he hasn't taught for a long time. He's like banging this. And Ajahn Mahal Bua telling the stories, as I was absolutely terrified. And he said, I could feel my liver shriveling. And this Tongva, he's just making this racket and noise, and he leaves me with that. And he said, and sure enough, Ajahn Mun called a meeting and sort of gave this blistering talk to everybody about how to practice and how to maintain mindfulness. And there's Ajahn, everybody else is sort of cringing under the sort of the wrath of the Ajahn, and Ajahn Tongla is sitting there smiling. Finally getting him to get the old guy to teach. Okay, it begins with a quote, knowledge and vision arose, and then how does knowledge differ from ordinary knowing and vision differ from ordinary seeing? Well, when we think of knowledge and vision in terms of that is in line with the teachings, in line with the Dhamma, then there'll always be the quality of relinquishment and letting go there. It's not so much, I think I mentioned this earlier today, it's not so much about some kind of attainment or gaining or getting, but it's knowledge that is able to relinquish attachment, relinquish clinging, relinquish views, an ability to really draw a self obsession, so that's knowledge and vision is always associated with that quality of letting go, of relinquishing, and being able to put down the burden, and so that's what true knowledge is. So it's not so much an intellectual understanding that one then carries around as a solid piece of information, but it's a clear recognition of that's problematic and it can be let go of, it can be relinquished. That's the end of the question.